Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Philip Ball, the author of The Beauty of Chemistry, Art, Wonder, and Science. Images and text capture the astonishing beauty of the chemical processes that create snowflakes, bubbles, flames, and other wonders of nature. Chemistry is not just about microscopic atoms doing inscrutable things. It is the process that makes flowers and galaxies. We rely on it for bread baking, vegetable growing, and producing the materials of daily life. In stunning images and illuminating text, this book captures chemistry as it unfolds. Using such techniques as microphotography, time-lapse photography, and infrared thermal imaging, The Beauty of Chemistry shows us how chemistry underpins the formation of snowflakes, the science of champagne, the colors of flowers, and other wonders of nature and technology. We see the marvelous configurations of chemical gardens, the amazing transformations of evaporation, distillation, and precipitation, heat made visible, and more. Well, Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. So as we're living through the unprecedented times during the coronavirus pandemic, well, quite a bit of time into the pandemic already, I'd like to start by asking, how has it affected you and your work?
Well, I feel like I've been one of the lucky ones who has been far less affected than most people, because as a writer, as a freelance writer, I work from home. So I've been able to carry on doing what I do without too much disruption. It's a little bit samey because I have no trips. I have not even into the center of town, into London. But nevertheless, I can continue working. And in fact, what it has meant is that, as with many people who write about science or communicate science in some form or another, the focus of my work has been, you know, so much geared towards looking into this pandemic, trying to communicate the science about it. But I think for me, also a lot of what I've been writing about is about how the science and the politics and the culture interact in an extraordinary situation like this. That's something that I've always been interested in writing about in my science writing. And this is such an unprecedented example of how those different aspects of society interact and how science, you know, affects us so immediately in our lives.
So did you find it easy to switch onto the pandemic coverage for your work?
Well, the way it happened really was that, you know, to begin with, and so I'm going right back to January of last year, when it only gradually became clear what we were really dealing with. And like a lot of people, you know, right at the outset, anyone who's followed scientific developments will be familiar with the notion that we were thinking, okay, we've seen similar things with SARS and with MERS and with bird flu and so on. You know, maybe it's going to be a bit like that. And so at the outset, I felt, well, you know, I've not tended so much to cover health issues. I tend to write more about primary science. So, you know, certainly life sciences, but in particular physics and chemistry. So I'll leave it to those people who really, you know, work on health, global health. That's their patch. And then little by little, I was asked to write a piece for the newspaper The Guardian here, and I went to interview an epidemiologist in the centre of London. It was probably the last journey I took into the centre of London for a year, really. I, after coming back from speaking to him, it was clear to me then, and I think this was late January, that actually this was going to be really big. And it was, in fact, during the cycle ride, you know, back at, back home, that I really started to appreciate this was something that was going to be so big that I really needed to get into it and to, you know, start familiarizing myself with the issues. At that point, it became clear that, you know, the focus of my world was going to change, as it did for many people. But for me in particular, it meant that the focus of my work was going to change. And it absolutely has for the past, you know, more than a year now. This is so much of what I've been writing about has been focused on the pandemic.
And yeah, for sure. And the science writers like you, they have played such an important role during this pandemic. So have you felt some extra maybe pressure, perhaps?
You know, in some ways, I probably have, because I felt, and I continue to feel, that it's never been more vital for people to have good information about so many aspects of the pandemic, you know, how it's panning out. There have been so many aspects of it that have been controversial and have been hard to navigate, and even hard for the experts, for the scientists, let alone for science communicators like me, let alone for the public. And so it's been a real struggle, but a real, really important thing to try to do. For example, to, you know, when the vaccines started to appear at the end of last year, I felt almost a frantic urgency to communicate why it was that we could place our trust in the way these vaccines have been checked out, that the haste with which they were, or the speed, really, I should say, with which they were developed, hadn't in any way compromised the care that had been taken in developing them and checking out their safety. That it was natural that people would worry about that, but there were very clear reasons for that speed that weren't about cutting corners. And so it felt really important to try to get that across to people, you know. And then at earlier stages of the pandemic, when there was the big debate about masks and, you know, about how the virus was being transmitted, all of these things, it just felt so important to try to get out to people as much as I could the best information that we had, even and to recognize the uncertainties. Because one of the really striking and troubling things about the pandemic has been the extent to which misinformation has been used, seized upon, politicized, really. You know, the whole pandemic has been politicized. Mm. It's really troubling to see how much that happened. And, you know, it's not just conspiracy theories, although there was a lot of that around. You know, it's misinformation sometimes coming from leaders, from politicians. All kinds of people had vested interests in, you know, putting one particular message across or another, often that involved distorting the science or cherry picking the science. And so I think, you know, it's really never been more important than it has been over the past year that there be science communicators, science writers who are really trying to get reliable information to people who, I think, you know, almost everyone is desperate for it. And I can really see how difficult it's been for people to navigate all of the different voices throughout this pandemic. But I do feel that, you know, that's been such an important task for people like me to try to do.
And it sounds that you took on the actual investigative role. So did you enjoy that part of it?
I've been having to do more of that perhaps than I've done in the past. I mean, it's a funny situation that we've been in, because you know, we haven't been able to, we science communicators, to do the usual thing one would do in that situation of going out to speak to people in their labs, to interview them. You know, it had to be, you had to do it all like this, you know, on Zoom or from home by phone. But, you know, in some way, I mean, it's, you know, it's been an interesting thing to see how that has happened and how in some ways that makes the job easier. How these new technologies have, everyone has had to use them. Everyone has been at home. The scientists, you know, generally have been at home available rather than out in the lab or at meetings or whatever. So, you know, in some ways that became easier. And also, you know, I've been making radio programs for the BBC during the pandemic. And that, again, has all been done from home, as it, you know, had to be. And it's been really interesting to see how it now can be. You know, I think we've all become used to accepting that programs, television programs, radio programs, aren't going to have absolutely the best audio quality. And, you know, you're going to be seeing images of people, you know, on screen, on their in Zoom instead of in person. And we've just got used to that. And I think actually there's something probably quite healthy about that, about recognizing that, you know, it needn't be about all these high quality production values, that actually it's, you can still get the message across in these other ways. So, you know, I think that that actually is going to persist. I think that we're going to see those sorts of approaches to, you know, making these programs, that's going to continue. And I kind of welcome that, because it means that it's, you know, it's much easier to do these things and it's less inhibiting, you know, than when you felt you had to be in a studio and get the highest audio quality. And it is possible to do so much with these resources.
So did you turn your laundry room into a recording studio? And can you give us the best duvet brand for sound isolation?
Well, absolutely. You see, before, that's what we'd have to do, you know, that if I had to record a little sort of insert for the BBC at home, you know, it would be only as a last resort and I'd have to try to use sound insulation and so on. And now all of that is gone, you know, because everyone accepts that it's going to sound as it is. So in some ways, you know, it's easier, and it means, you know, you might sometimes have background noise. And, you know, whereas in the past, if someone was doing an interview this way and the kids walked in, you know, that would sort of go viral and everyone would sort of love it. And now it's just normal. There, you know, that's happening all the time. It may happen now. I hope it won't, but, you know, we may hear some background noises. I think that's the culture that we're now in, and I think in some ways, like I say, that's not a bad thing.
Oh, for sure. And I actually find all of these background noises quite precious. I've been listening to the BMJ podcast, the British Medical Journal, and you can hear the birds on the background. It's really, really strange.
Yeah, well, and in some ways, you know, it reminds us that all of these things, and, you know, scientists talking about their work, it's happening in the real world. It, you know, gets rid of this need for a sort of artificial perfection in talking about it, that actually, of course, you know, like everyone, they're people at home with kids or families or, you know, with you know, bedrooms and bookshelves and so on. So no, I've made recordings. I have a little home office, but, you know, some recordings I've made upstairs in the bedroom or down the garden in the shed, depending on what seemed best under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And there's something very nice about that.
So as I mentioned, you work for BBC. So can you also tell us a bit more about your background, perhaps in science and journalism?
Sure. Yes. Well, I feel as though the situation that I'm in now, and I'm a freelance writer, as I say, I can sort of define it no better than that, is something that I never planned. I kind of wandered into. I'm still finding my way, you know, around it after decades of having done it, because when I began on this path, whatever it is, there it was not really a professionalized business at all. Science communication. There were people who wrote, you know, science writers for the newspapers, but science writing was, there was no sort of set way into it. These days, there are science communication, science journalism courses that one can take at university. And I think it's fantastic that those exist and what I've seen of them, and I've sometimes taken part in them, and they seem very good. But, you know, I began this in the late 80s after finishing my PhD in physics. And I realized that actually, unusually, I had actually enjoyed writing up my thesis, and I'd enjoyed writing the papers, and I'd realized that actually I'd always enjoyed writing. I've always, you know, done writing on the side, but it had never occurred to me before, because no one had even suggested it, that one could combine a love of writing and a love of science. So I figured maybe this was possible, and I thought, you know, maybe I should go into science editing. And so I just sent off letters. In those days, it had to be letters. There was no email, to see whether there were jobs around. And I was extraordinarily lucky that a space opened up at Nature, the science journal, you know, just at that right time that I happened to fit. My first degree was in chemistry and then in physics, and they were looking for someone with that kind of background as an editor there. And these were the days where, these days, Nature is a publishing empire, and it has, I lose track of how many journals are in the Nature, under the Nature titles. But in those days, it was just a single journal, and it was run out of a, you know, cramped office just off the Strand in London. And it was a fantastic place to be. It meant that my job was as an editor deciding which papers to publish, but so there was no formal part of the job that meant I needed to write anything. But if one was interested in doing that, as I was, then there were opportunities to write for newspapers and so forth. And so I pursued those opportunities at the same time as being an editor. And after several years, I figured, well, maybe I'd like to write a book. And so I did that. And I did that as a full-time editor at Nature. And it was horrendous in the sense that the job was already...
Oh,
yeah, it was, you know, I was getting up at 5-6 in the morning and writing a little bit of it before I went into work. And so when I finished that, I said, well, I'd like to write another, but I don't want to do it that way again. So I went part-time at Nature and gradually sort of stepped down until finally I officially cut my ties as an employee at Nature. I guess this was over 20 years ago, and became freelance. By which time, I guess I'd written enough books, and I had, you know, figured I had enough contacts to be able to find places to write for New Scientist and, you know, the scientific media, as well as continuing to write for Nature. Actually, I still do that now. So I kind of wandered into into this position, and I feel it's an extraordinarily fortunate position. It's a real privilege to be in this position where I can choose what I want to write about. I can follow my own interests, whether it's for books or for journalism, and, you know, and just do that, and do that at my own pace, and, you know, in a place and at a time of my own choosing. So that's really what the work consists of now. And it means it's a mixture of things. I do some, you know, some of the time is spent book writing, some of it is spent journalistically. And I have done things sort of quasi-regularly for the BBC, which is another kind of communication, which I've enjoyed tremendously. It's a very different set of challenges to present a radio program. So it really depends on what comes along, what takes my fancy.
Interesting. So earlier mentioned that you really enjoyed writing your thesis and papers during your academic time. But of course, communicating to public is much different. So did you always have this drive for communication? And how did you manage to master those skills?
To whatever extent I have mastered them, and there's always more to learn, it was learning on the job, learning, you know, literally by making mistakes, I guess. There was a lot of technical learning that I did at Nature in terms of, you know, when I started, editors would need to learn how to sub-edit. So to have a bit of text and to turn it into something more readable and to get rid of all the grammatical errors and so on, which I am fantastically grateful for the opportunity to, you know, to learn that, because that's such an important skill, whether you're trying to edit your own text or anyone else's. But beyond that, you know, I've never had a formal course in how to communicate science. So you learn by trial and error. But I think particularly, and I think this is the advice that is often given to people who are interested in learning to write, by reading people who do it well, and, you know, trying to the extent that you can to understand what it is about that particular writing that works for you. That's kind of how it comes about. I mean, it's a mixture of things. I think that, you know, part of what I do is straight journalism, where it's really a sort of job of translation, of trying to communicate what may be quite an esoteric piece of science in language that a general audience can understand. And that's, you know, that in itself is a nice challenge, and that's an important part of it. But I think increasingly what I felt is an important part of what I want to do is to create context, is not so much to translate the science, but to try to embed it within the broader culture. To explain, you know, where these ideas come from, what they might mean culturally, and how they're received culturally. So what I've found myself writing about has been much more, it's been about how science interacts, for example, with political systems, how science has interacted with the arts, and really how science, and with literature, you know, and how science interacts, how it is a part of a broader culture. What I'm very keen to try to do is to bring science out of the what sometimes seems like a bit of a ghetto, or certainly a niche, you know, that appeals to a certain kind of readership, to try to bring it out of that and to contextualize it and to show how scientific developments and thoughts, and really the ideas, how they change cultures. And I think that's really the thing that has drawn me to science communication. It's about the ideas and how ideas develop, and how ideas are interpreted by different parts of society. So that's really the focus, I think, of a lot of what I try to write about, to give science context.
Oh, absolutely. And also, I think I can add that putting a bit of imagination into it as well, because, for example, in chemistry, you have your Eppendorf tube with the white or even clear liquid, so you don't even see what's going on, but then it's a whole world happening inside. So when you came to writing your book about chemistry, how did that happen?
Well, this particular one, I mean, I should say first of all that the first book I wrote was about chemistry, and my first degree was in chemistry, and I feel that there's a little bit of a mission in me. Although I write across the sciences, chemistry is the kind of key central sciences. Chemistry is the neglected one. It is far less popularized than, you know, there are many books about cosmology and quantum physics and, you know, string theory. People love that sort of esoteric part of physics. There are many books about evolution, human evolution, you know, medicine and health. But chemistry has few people championing it. And that was something I was keen to do. And it's a real challenge because, as you say, what you tend to see in chemistry, you don't have these big particle accelerators. You don't have the abundance of the natural world. I mean, in both of those cases, there are aspects of chemistry that are relevant. But, you know, you tend to have often a flask with, you know, a liquid in it that might just be a clear liquid. It's very hard to convey what molecules do, things that we never directly see or experience. So that's, you know, that's the challenge with chemistry. And it's one that I enjoy trying to tackle. But what happened with this particular book, The Beauty of Chemistry, was it was in a way it was handed to me on a plate, because I was contacted by so the book is made in collaboration with two photographers. It feels like that doesn't do them justice, actually. They're artists, both of them, Yen Liang and Wenting Zhu. in China who run a project called Envisioning Chemistry, and they make these astonishing videos, kind of stop motion videos and time lapse videos of chemical processes, of crystals growing and things solids precipitating in a way that is just extraordinarily beautiful. I'm so admiring of the art of what they do. And I was in China. I spent, before the pandemic, I regularly went to China, and I can't wait to get back for various reasons. And one time when I was there, Yen contacted me. He was in Shanghai. He was in Beijing. I was in Shanghai. And he said, look, I'm, you know, interested in perhaps writing a book based on the work we do. And he showed me the work, and I, you know, was astonished at it. And so he came down from Beijing and we met up in the hotel and chatted. And this was going back several years now, and both agreed, you know, we'd be interested in doing something together if the opportunity arose. And then I guess it must be about 2 years ago now, Yen contacted me and said, look, I've got this, I've been talking with MIT Press about making a book of the, you know, the images from the movies we've made. Would you be interested in writing the text? And so I jumped at the chance, because it was just inspiring to do, to have these images, you know, as the source of inspiration. And I just knew that it would be such fun, because, you know, there was no pressure to convey any particularly sort of complicated chemical ideas or something. What I really wanted to do here was to convey something of the beauty, the wonder, the allure of chemical processes in a way that tried to do justice to the you know, the glorious visual way that Yen and Wenting had captured. So that was basically how it came about. And it was just a, you know, complete pleasure to have that freedom to try to convey in a way that said something about the images, you know, explained something about what we are seeing, but also, I hope, conveying something of that sort of wonder and that excitement about the stuff of chemistry. And I think that was, you know, that was really what I wanted to get across, because that has always been, and it was the reason I studied chemistry in the first place, and I chose to study chemistry. It's the stuff. It's these colours. It's the crystals. The kind of sensuous nature of chemistry. The smells, actually, and sometimes the, you know, the bangs, the explosions. All of this, I think, is very often meant. So many chemists say that's what drew them to the subject. There's something ascetic about it that I don't think you necessarily see, or not in the same way, in physics and in biology. So it was that I really wanted to try to convey.
Yeah, for sure. And that's something that really sets this book apart, that this beautiful amalgam of expertise that you bring as a chemist, and also your colleagues who are artists. So thinking about chemistry in everyday life, where do we find beauty in that?
That's, I suppose, one thing that I'm hoping to at least set people thinking about, because the kinds of things that Yen and Wenting are looking at in this book are things that we can find around us if we are sensitized to look, to pay attention to what is going on. So, for example, there's a chapter on, they have these wonderful images of flowers, the colours in flowers, and how those colours might be changed in by chemical processes, by just putting certain chemicals on the petals. You can sometimes get extraordinary changes in colour. For, you know, what one example that I think many people might be familiar with is that hydrangeas are the colour of the, well, I will say the flowers. It's actually they're a kind of modified leaf that is actually has the colour in hydrangeas. So, you know, we're familiar with the idea that they're often pink or blue or, you know, somewhere in between, a kind of mauvish colour. And that colour is determined by the acidity or the alkalinity of the soil in which they're growing. And so you can chemically manipulate that. So, you know, that's an example that is familiar to everyone. And I think a lot of people who do gardening will know, you know, that much chemistry, that actually the kind of soil in which you plant your hydrangea will determine what color it is, and that you can perhaps alter that by just, you know, adding a bit of alkali to the soil, for example. So, yeah, that's one, you know, very everyday example. The shapes of crystals, you know, that I think we never particularly think to look at, you know, the shapes of sugar crystals or salt crystals. But actually, if you, you know, if you do, you find that they have these very distinctive shapes, that salt crystals, sodium chloride, has that it tends to form tiny little cubes. And that cubic shape is directly related to the way the atoms, or the ions, as they really are packed together in the crystals. So, you know, in some, with something we can see with our naked eye, there is an echo of the symmetry, the shapes that are adopted by the at the atomic scale in this substance. So that's the kind of thing that I, you know, wanted to try to explore in these books. And, you know, the images that Yen and Wenting have made really bring that across when you sort of see these crystals form. And I think they do, if I remember rightly, I think we do maybe have some images of sodium chloride. And actually, they, you know, they alone can be incredibly beautiful when you, you know, look at them close up, and when you have the skills that Yen and Wenting have for photographing them in the right way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, for sure. And one of my sort of things that I really like is molten salt from England coast. And it actually goes into these really, really clear crystals. So it's really funny to look at, and I suppose it tastes like salt. But what can you tell me about chemistry in food?
In food, yes. Well, you know, I think that is probably the form of chemistry that most of us are most familiar with, although we may not think of it in chemical terms unless you happen to be a chemist. But absolutely, I mean, people, you know, often compare chemistry to cooking, and it's not a flippant comparison by any means, because there are a lot of similarities. And in fact, cooking is a kind of chemistry. You know, for example, when we roast or fry a piece of meat or something, then what we're doing is carrying out a particular chemical reaction. In that case, it's one called the Maillard reaction, which is one that turns some of the it essentially kind of caramelizes some of the, it breaks down some of the proteins, and you get the formation of some sugars in the process, and you get that sort of rich mixture of flavors, when something is fried or roasted that way. It creates the browning that is a kind of caramelization, and and that's where the flavors come from. That's one sort of familiar example. I mean, you know, baking is another that the process there is that, you know, the baking powder is it's bicarbonate that is breaking down and releasing carbon dioxide, and that blows the bubbles that you get in bread or in cakes. You know, it's all a kind of chemical transformation generally brought about by heat. I mean, another one is in frying or boiling an egg, where, you know, you get this transformation from the transparent substance, the albumin, the egg white in the raw egg, sets and becomes this white opaque material. That's a process in which the proteins in that transparent substance, they undergo a process called denaturation, which is where they lose the natural structure that they have. They sort of unwind, and then they all these unwound strands tangle together, and that sort of tangling creates the opaque whiteness. It's a little bit, because it scatters light, it's a little bit like the same kind of whiteness that you see in milk. And so all those proteins are then sort of tangled together. And once that happens, you're stuck with it. You can't untangle them. So you can't, you know, unfry or unboil an egg. All of these processes that happen in the kitchen, there's, you know, an awful lot of chemistry that's going on behind them.
Yeah, perhaps the lockdowns also made a big chunk of population chemists with all the sourdough baking and...
Oh, absolutely. Well, and, you know, in some ways, microbiologists as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Know,
yeah.
Everyone was having to, yes, when you have to sort of sustain these, you know, these, what do they call them anyway? The substances, the solution that is needed for sourdough. So, yeah, that too is, it's a biochemical process.
So all of these phenomena that you were talking about, it takes its place on a very microscopic scales, or even on, in a way that is not even visible to the visible light. So what sort of technologies help us look into this invisible chemical world?
Well, we have been able to do that to some degree since the early 20th century. It was really then that we started to get techniques that could magnify or to that extent. So before that, the end of the 19th century, you know, there were microscopes, and through those microscopes you could see individual living cells, and you could start to see, at that time the microscopes were good enough to see inside the cells and to see some of the structure very vaguely that existed in cells, but it just looked like sort of blobs. You couldn't really make much out. But in the early 20th century, the technique called X-ray crystallography was invented, which involves bouncing X-rays off of crystals, and because the crystals have atoms that are stacked in very sort of regular patterns, what happens is that as the X-rays bounce off, different rays might bounce off from different layers in that stacking, and the different rays interfere with each other because they're waves, and so sometimes the sort of peaks of the waves might coincide and reinforce each other. Sometimes they might, your peak might coincide with the trough, and they'll cancel each other out, and so you get patterns of bright and dark spots of X-rays in the reflected beam that can be recorded on initially in those days it was photographic film, which is sensitive to X-rays, and so you get these patterns of spots. And people realized, really starting with Lawrence and William Bragg in the 1910s 1920s, they figured out that from this pattern of spots, mathematically you could figure out where the layers of atoms had to be. And so, you know, if you could do that for enough different layers, you could sort of pretty much figure out where the atoms were. So that was a technique for actually being able to pinpoint literally how the atoms were arranged in crystals. And to begin with, they did it with simple substances like sodium chloride, like salt, or with metals. And as people got better this technique, you could do it with more complicated substances. And in particular, it became possible gradually, decades later, to figure out where the atoms in organic and biological substances like proteins, crystals of proteins, where they, how they were arranged. And so we began to be able to use X-ray crystallography to understand the shapes of complex molecules like proteins. And that has been, I think, it's very clearly one of the most important scientific methods of the modern age, because understanding the structures of molecules, biological molecules like proteins, enables us to understand how they work, how they do the job that they do. And the same technique was used to understand the structure of DNA, the stuff that encodes our genes. And, you know, it was through that work, through X-ray crystallography of DNA, that it became clear how DNA encodes genes and how it's able to replicate when cells divide. So the fundamental processes of life really were understood that way. But, you know, as the century progressed, there were other techniques for figuring out where atoms reside. I mean, one that goes back to certainly to the 19th century, called spectroscopy, is something where we can look at how atoms and molecules and substances interact with light to absorb certain wavelengths. And in general, they absorb them when there's some kind of vibration in the substance that is at the right frequency to absorb a particular wavelength of light. Those vibrations tend to be vibrations of atoms, or often of the bonds that are joining atoms. And so we can, by using spectroscopy, we can start to understand what kinds of bonds and what kinds of chemical groups exist within the substance. So again, we can find something out about the molecular structure. And these days, you know, there are other techniques. There are things like nuclear magnetic resonance, which is another kind of spectroscopy, which, you know, helps us to understand what types of element are in a substance and what sort of environment they're in. And so there's a big array now of methods for understanding structure. And we've even got to the stage where we have new forms of microscopy that don't use light, but use electron beams initially. And these days there are types of microscopy that can just measure the forces that are felt by a tiny little sort of tip scanning across the surface, and those forces sort of go increase and decrease as the tip scans across arrays of atoms. And using this technique, we can actually take images, real images, of what atoms and molecules look like, what sort of shapes they have. So, you know, we finally have a kind of microscopy that can see right down to the scale of atoms and molecules.
For sure. And spectroscopy techniques can also help us to peer into the chemistry on the planets beyond Earth, can it? So are you excited about the chemistry of the outside world?
Oh, yeah, this is, you know, an utterly extraordinary thing. I mean, in fact, this goes really back to the middle of the 19th century. It was in the 1860s, if I remember rightly, that the element helium was discovered, because it was the first element that was discovered not on Earth, but actually on another object. So it was actually discovered in the sun, because of the way this element absorbs sunlight, that we were able to split apart the spectrum of sunlight and see that bits of it had been sort of chopped out, if you like, because they were being absorbed. And they were being absorbed at frequencies that didn't correspond to anything we knew on Earth. And so it was, you know, figured that this must be an element that hadn't been seen before. And it's called helium, from the Greek helios, the name for the sun. So, you know, we could understand the composition of stars this way. And these days, these same techniques, spectroscopic techniques looking at starlight, can tell us something about the composition of the atmospheres of planets around other stars. And there are now thousands of these planets known. By looking at the way the light of the parent star of the planets, how that is changed when the starlight passes through the atmosphere of the planet. And there are, you know, it's incredibly clever how we can figure out, when that's happening, and how we can sort of pick out the bit of the starlight that has been absorbed by the atmosphere of a planet going around it. By looking at that, we are able to say, to deduce something about what it is, what kinds of chemicals, what kinds of molecules are in the atmospheres of those planets. And so in this way, we found that there are planets that, for example, have water in their atmospheres, as we'd actually expect planets to do, because water is one of the most common molecules in the whole of the cosmos. But that's a very exciting thing, because if we know that there are planets that have water in their atmospheres, we can hope to find out that whether there might be planets that are cool enough that, you know, that there may be liquid water on their surface, which would make them, as far as we know it, that would make them potentially inhabitable by life of the sort that we know on Earth. So these techniques are now being used to study the composition of planets, you know, in other solar systems, many, many light years away, and to figure out whether some of those planets have atmospheres like Earth, or at least have atmospheres that might be suitable for hosting life.
Yeah, this is absolutely mind-boggling. So, as you mentioned before, chemistry is not yet capturing people's imagination as much as physics or astrophysics, but you are making a really compelling case for why it should. So why would people be really interested in it?
Well, I think partly it's just a matter of making people recognize where chemistry is. That, you know, it's not rows of chemicals in bottles in a chemical lab. It's actually everything around us is, you know, every substance we have is a chemical substance. It's all made of some sorts of chemicals. And once we start to become sensitized to ask questions about that, for example, you know, why is this substance this color? What are the dyes in the stuff that I'm wearing? Why are they that color? Well, there are particular chemicals that absorb light and have been selected to absorb, for their ability to absorb light and to create that color. So this is how we make dyes. Most of these dyes these days are synthetic. They're made in laboratories and in factories because they have those characteristics. Chemistry, it is all around us if we remember to ask the right sorts of questions. And, you know, chemistry is now being, I mean, it's been very clear in the way the Nobel Prizes have been awarded in chemistry for decades now, that so much of the living world is, I mean, pretty essentially all of it is really a chemical process. You know, living things are made of chemicals, of molecules like the proteins that I was talking about earlier. So understanding what life is primarily a chemical question. And, you know, I think, again, that this is something that perhaps we might be a little more sensitized to through the pandemic. That the vaccines that we have are chemical products. They are, you know, for example, the new vaccines, the so-called mRNA vaccines, they use a particular kind of chemistry. They use these biochemicals, mRNA, to produce the sort of proteins that eventually the proteins that are in the coronavirus that raise our antibodies and, you know, get our immune system working against the virus. So it is, in the end, chemistry that we have to thank for the fact that we now have these vaccines.
Yeah, for sure. And so in your book, you, of course, tell the story of chemistry in a very visual, stunning way. But I'm curious whether it can deepen our understanding of the scientific phenomena. For example, the snowflakes. I only recently found out that all the paper snowflakes I was making are not really anatomically correct.
So I guess they were eight pointed.
That's right, yeah.
Which is the normal way of ranking. I'm afraid I'm a real pedant with my kids, so I forbid eight pointed snowflakes on the whole. They have to be six
only
pointed.
Correct.
Yes, absolutely. It pains me too much. Although what we really do, and if, you know, we did it this year and we did it last year, that when we have snow in winter now, I have a cheap macro lens that I can, you know, just clip over my mobile phone and go out and take photos of snowflakes. And it's possible, if the snow is the right kind of snow, it's possible to get fantastic pictures of snowflakes. And it's something I know what I'm going to see. I've seen so many pictures of snowflakes, but I still find there's just a complete thrill that I get from, you know, being able to just walk out the front door and take the pictures of these amazing objects that are basically, you know, they're crystals of ice, but they have these incredibly intricate patterns, and there are billions of them coming down from the sky, and they're just going to disappear. There is this incredible abundance of beauty in nature that, you know, just so happens that that's the way the crystallization process works when water vapor freezes in the sky. So, you know, I think that's a fantastic example, not just of the fact that the world is chemical, but that actually there's a real richness in those sorts of processes. And Yen and Wen-Ting have made some fabulous movies. And, you know, we've got some images of this, of the same kind of process happening in other substances, metals, sometimes when they solidify from the molten form. Sometimes they too will form these so-called dendritic structures, which are like individual snowflake arms. But some of them, because of the fact that the metals have different crystal structures, different arrangements of the atoms in the crystal, they don't have this six-pointed characteristic that snowflakes have. They might be four-pointed, so the side branches don't come out at the sort of angle, the 60-degree angles that you see in snowflakes. They come out at right angles, so, you know, they look a little different. And you can understand why that difference exists by understanding the difference in the crystal structures. So again, we're seeing something that we can see, you know, pretty much with our naked eye, that reflects that what is going on for the molecule, for the atoms and the molecules in those systems. So yeah, I think, you know, snowflakes are one of the best examples of the what, you know, clearly is, and I think everyone would recognize this incredible beauty that chemical processes can bring about.
So has anything surprised you really, really deeply when you were researching the book?
Well, I guess a lot of the things that I was writing about were familiar to me. You know, I was I loved the images, but I kind of knew what I was looking at. However, there was one thing where there was a final chapter that I really wanted to encourage Yen and Wen-Ting to be able to create images for, which is about patterns. So we have a separate section on things like snowflakes, but at the end we have different kinds of patterns that chemical processes can form. And some of them are related to the kinds of patterns that we might see in animal markings or insect markings or butterfly wings. That these two are chemical processes. And they were trying to create a certain kind of pattern called a chemical garden or a silicate garden. And it's something that has been known. In fact, I talk about in the book about how it goes right back at least to the 17th century. People started seeing these complicated forms that could be made from, you know, inorganic. They look like sort of molds or something or mushrooms, but they're actually made from the substance called water glass, which is basically a bit like a sort of solution of glass, literally. So they're completely inorganic. And at one point he said, look, we found these images when we were working with this stuff. What do you think they are? And I'd never seen that. They looked a bit familiar. They were kind of rings of crystallization that were happening on the edge of the flasks that they were using with this water glass in it. But I'd never come across that process before. And so I, you know, asked a few people who were experts in this field about it, and they hadn't seen it before. And they, you know, had some ideas about what was going on. But it was rather lovely to find, you know, this surprising thing that it seemed no one had noticed before, this new kind of patterning process. So we have those in the book. We're not 100% sure how they're forming. We have ideas about that. But that was quite exciting to find something we hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, and something that also stuns me is the fractals that are present in some of the really microscopic levels. Even the same snowflakes, some of them are fractals.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, snowflakes are an example of this. These structures called fractals, which basically what that means is that they are structures that have certain elements that just repeat and repeat again and again at smaller scales. So the snowflakes have six branches. Those branches have side branches coming off. Sometimes you get side branches coming off those. It's a little bit like the structures that you see in ferns, so in living, you know, organisms that you know, fractal structures are very common in the living world. I mean, trees have a fractal structure with the, you know, the central trunk, and then the branches split, and then they split off, and eventually they become little twigs. But you see fractal structures of various sorts also in some crystallization processes, where you don't get blocky crystals, you get these branching sort of patterns. And there are several examples of very, very beautiful examples like that of crystal growth in the book too.
So after writing the book, have you changed any ways that you view or do something in everyday life? Maybe the way you brew your coffee?
You know, I think it was actually the book that made me that inspired me to think, look, you know, if we're kind of lucky enough to have snow in the winter, which is more rare now in these times of climate warming, sadly, but we do still get it. We got it this year. If that happens, get out there. Get out there with this camera and take some images. And, you know, it's really possible and actually quite easy to do that. And, you know, they have nothing like the beauty that Yen and Wenting's images have, but it's still exciting because I can do it myself, and I can do it, you know, sort of outside my front door. So actually, I think although, you know, I felt probably to begin with, oh, okay, I know all about these chemical processes that are going on, you know, I know what I'm writing about, just the fact of seeing these wonderful images that they had produced is inspired me to want to, you know, look for them and to look for them in crystal. I mean, you know, one of the things that's been happening also, of course, during lockdown, although it happened for us before that as well, because we home educated our children when they were younger. So, you know, we've been doing some of their schoolwork with them and some of their scientific work with them. And it's meant that we've been doing some experiments like this, and you know, that's been rather lovely to be looking at things like, you know, trying to grow crystals of, you know, colored sugar or something, just to see what we can do, or mixing up cornstarch and, you know, a cornstarch solution and seeing it suddenly solidify if you stir it too fast. You know, it's lovely to have the motivation, the reason to actually go back and play with some of these simple chemical processes, because, you know, there's still, for me, there's still a wonder to be had from them. Even if they're familiar to me and I understand what's going on, there's still an excitement in actually doing it.
Yeah, for sure. And beyond just opening up the whole new world of chemistry in a book, it actually makes you so curious to, as you say, to go there and do stuff and look for things. So, yeah.
I really hope that it has that sort of inspiring effect on people, you know, as it did on me. Because again, you know, one of the messages we want to get across is this isn't stuff that is, you know, only going to happen in labs. I mean, the same with this chapter on flowers. You know, you can do this. You can go out there and, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a garden, or if you have an access to a garden, you know, you can go and look in detail and look under a microscope or under a lens, you know, at what these structures and petals look like. The same with butterfly wings. I mean, that's something else we did, that, you know, if you have a reasonably good microscope and you get a butterfly wing and look at it in detail, you see these tiny little scales that are kind of tiled together to make up the pigmented patterns. So, you know, it's all out there if we know what to look for.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on?
Well, I don't think this is lockdown related, but it just so happened that I found myself essentially working on four books at the same time. So I have this one coming out in May, and I actually have another book coming out at pretty much the same time, which is a very different book. It's about modern myths, and so it looks at the stories that we have told, mostly literary stories, although increasingly they're in other media, that I argue have the genuine status that myth used to have, that the classical myths used to have. So these are stories like Frankenstein, Jekyll and Hyde, Dracula, and I'm looking at, first of all, why I feel they can be classified as myths, and what function do they serve? Because myths have functions. They had functions in the ancient world, and, you know, the fact that we are creating these stories and giving them mythical status means that we have some need for them. So I'm really sort of burrowing into what these stories are really about, what they reveal about the modern world, really, and about our modern way of being. So that's out there. I've been working on a book. I won't say much about it now, but it's a book about the kinds of minds that can exist in the world. And by that, I mean, it's looking at the range of human minds that exist, because we now recognize there's a diversity of human minds, how they compare with animal minds, whether we can genuinely start to think about at least the minds of machines, AI. I'd look a little bit about into whether we can deduce anything about the kinds of minds that might exist on these other planets, these possibly inhabitable planets that we know must be out there in the cosmos. So it's a book that is trying to look at the landscape of minds that might exist in the universe.
Oh, that sounds super exciting. Looking forward to reading the books about myths and minds as well. Well, half the time I don't understand the mind of my guinea pigs, so hopefully you can shine some light on that.
We have guinea pigs too, and I think they're going to be forever a mystery.
Oh yeah, for sure. So where can our listeners find more information about your book and also your work?
Oh, well, the book The Beauty of Chemistry is being published by MIT Press, so it will certainly be on their site. So this is Massachusetts Institute of Technology Press, which has done an absolutely fantastic job. You know, it's no easy task for any publisher to take on the kinds of image heavy book that this is, with, and they've done a glorious job of reproducing these images. So that's available through MIT Press. The book on myths is being published by the University of Chicago Press.
Excellent. And your work, do you have a blog or?
I have I certainly have a website, www.philipball.co.uk, and I try to keep that updated with what I've published and what I'm bringing out. That tends to be, as these things are, tends to be sporadic. Usually the you know, whatever it is that I'm publishing, I tend to talk about on Twitter as well. So you can find me on Twitter and see what I'm up to. So those are probably the best places to look.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been truly delightful conversation.
Oh, thank you, Galina. No, it's been lovely talking to you.